This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, how UC students are creating lovable sidekicks for children experiencing homelessness. First up, Newport, Kentucky was known as America's playground from the 1920s to the 1960s, when Monmouth Street was ground zero for casinos, brothels, and mobsters. The Sin City of the South didn't last forever. With reform movements and law enforcement crackdowns, the city began to clean up its act. Here to discuss Newport's history are American Legacy Tours co-founder Jerry Gels and retired Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Terry Flynn. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Terry and Jerry, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Jerry, start us off by telling us, how did this happen? What started Newport down this road of becoming a hotbed of gambling and prostitution and organized crime and widespread corruption?
So, there's a lot of words you use there that sound kind of like ugly words. But to be honest with you, it was a pretty clean, good place to have a family and to work, you know, for a long period of time. So what happens in Newport, what really makes Newport special is really after Prohibition. You see, after Prohibition, there's a lot of people that learn how to make money, you know, in illegal means, mostly through alcohol. And when that's no longer accessible, they still want to stay in business. And what they remembered was seeing the, you know, super wealthy person next to the really poor person, you know, drinking. But the wealthy people, when they entered their next vice, which was gambling, you know, they're playing $150, $200 hands of blackjack. So what a lot of these guys that were involved in the Prohibition business realized is that if they created the casinos, and rather than having them in the back sheds or rather having them in the basement someplace and really cater to kind of like that high-end clientele, that they could make a lot of money. And the first people really realize that and do it on a grand scale were the people in Newport, Kentucky.
How many casinos did Newport have operating in it?
So at its peak, when we talk about high-end casinos, we're talking about carpet joints, right? Kind of what you would almost
experience. That was
experience.
The term you used for a high-end casino.
Yeah.
Okay.
As opposed to bust-out joints.
Yeah, as opposed to bust-out joints.
You have to explain
that,
Terry.
You know, there's a couple other names, but bust-out joint was a rough place. But carpet joints, there's about 11. And, you know, not just do we have these casinos in Newport, but, you know, if you think about like Vegas, where people talk about seeing slot machines at the airport and the grocery store, that's what you had in Newport. You had slot machines in Dixie Chili and the barbershops and the grocery stores. And one person had a dog food place or like a kennel, and they had slot machines in there. So, and they were up and down. They had a gaming stamp on them. These people paid their taxes, so they were okay with the federal government. Right. So the next big question is why didn't state government shut it down? You see, during this time, you had some different rules in Kentucky, you know, on the books. And one of them was that state government really can't have any influence on your city unless they're invited in. And this community, because of, you know, the anti-immigrant sentiment, you know, 30 and 20 years prior, a lot of the racism that the Catholic immigrants and other immigrant groups had to deal with, developed in this small community, kind of take care of your own. You know, it's hard to get in Newport. You got to take a bridge to get across the Ohio, and you got to take a bridge to go in there from Covington. And Campbell County isn't all that populated. So this population in Newport is rather, you know, kind of insulated from everybody else, and it's their rules, and that's how they kept it for about 35, 40 years.
So we've got carpet joints and then you bust-out joints. Terry, what are those?
If you went there to drink and to gamble, there was at least a 50-50 chance that you might get thrown back out the door at some point during the night without any of your money. They were off the main, like not York or Monmouth. They were down a little further in the West End, Mabel and Q's and places like that, where it was – you were taking a chance when you went there. A lot of people did, you know, and of course they also – almost all of them
– So these are places where the house always won.
And even if you didn't gamble, you might get robbed. That's why they called them bust-out joints.
Oh my gosh.
And you always had hookers also. That was just standard procedure.
So prostitution was going on in that area too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, prostitution was a pretty big vice too. I mean, there was in fact, if there was a big convention in Cincinnati, you know, I read they would bus in somewhere around, you know, 150 to 350 extra prostitutes from Louisville and Lexington.
So what was this doing in terms of this reputation, because it was called Sin City, it was also known as America's Playground. What was this doing for tourism? I mean, how many people were attracted to Newport?
So at its peak, there was about 1.2 million people a year coming to Newport to gamble. I mean, and these were like, you know,
wow,
celebrities and big names. I mean, Elvis Presley, Marilyn Monroe. Now, they might be they might have been brought into town to perform at, say, you know, some of the nicer places like your Beverly Hills, but then you could also catch them playing. So that was probably the other excitement, where you could brush up next to a celebrity. And then, you know, the other thing, I mean, people write about this. I think we found a story recently where Mickey Mantle, coming home from spring training, they decided to stop in Newport, and they missed their bus home, right? And they were so hungover that but they were nervous because they were going to miss – I think it was opening day, you know, so something happened. And again, the coach played them, you know, hungover and, you know, through the entire game mostly to teach them a lesson, you know. So people – there's all kinds of celebrities. And if you're – it's amazing. Like, you'll read an autobiography here or there, and you'll read about these little incidences in Newport. And even Frank Sinatra, he's got, you know, one of his stories about being in Newport, Kentucky.
Wow. So all these celebrities are coming through. 1.2 million people every year?
Every year, yeah.
And I think the town had, what, a population of 30,000 at that time?
35.
Maybe. But if you added in all the people who were coming in, you had probably had a population closer to three times that, I would imagine.
In Shirley MacLaine, I guess it was her first book, and she talked about when they were working in Madison, Indiana, she and Frank and Dino on Some Came Running, and they had a break. And the two of them said, "You're coming with us." And they came up here. And she tells in the book, they walked into Beverly, and she said it was like God had walked through the door when they saw Sinatra. It was, she said, it was amazing. It didn't matter what he wanted. He would get it. Of course, at that time, 57, 58, they were going really strong. The mob was, you know, the Cleveland Syndicate ran the place. And Frank knew all those guys, so it was not unusual at all for, you know, the names passing through town or whatever. They almost always stopped at Lookout House, Beverly, one of the good spots.
Was the Cleveland Syndicate, was that the biggest organization that was operating in Newport?
No, so they were all there. You had Mo Dallas, you had the Eastern Syndicate, Purple Gang. At one point tried to come in. The Chicago Outfit tried to come in. But Mo Dalitz and Meyer Lansky and a few of the others involved had this kind of there's enough for everybody kind of rule. The people that they really took the business to were the local operators. You see, the local operators, when these national guys come in, they're just dumbfounded. They've never seen anything like this, right? In fact, when the Cleveland Syndicate came through, you know, they walked in the Beverly Hills and they said, "This is the future," right? It was owned by Pete Schmidt at the time. And, you know, what they did is just like you see in the Godfather movies, they first start off with a ridiculously great lucrative offer. But, you know, these guys that own these places, they're entrepreneurs, they want to be millionaires, and they decide not to sell. And so you do have your classical gangster, you know, narrative of takeovers, and it's pretty interesting. Former people, you know, low-level lieutenants that were mentored by the higher-level guys, they would switch sides, and they'd be responsible for certain hits and things like that. And but this is what you have to understand. So if you think about, name almost the biggest gangster names that you've heard of, your Meyer Lansky's, your Frank Costello's, Lucky Luciano, you know, Mo Dalitz, the Levisons, these guys all have ownership stakes eventually in casinos in Newport. Those are also all the first investors in the first nine casinos in Las Vegas. Las Vegas doesn't exist without Newport. So not only do you need you need a business model. They learned this would work. The national syndicates learned that a gambling would work by what they saw in Newport. Second thing is you need money, which is what they brought to and what the gambling was giving them in Newport. The third thing you need is trained people that know how to run these establishments and cater that high-end clientele. And so that's what these guys have. And then Las Vegas does something that Newport can't, which is offer the promise of free gambling. So while it was fairly wide open, there were times when you had to close down. But it was also, you know, at the end of the day, it was illegal. So once airfare becomes safer and cheaper, Las Vegas opens. And where would you rather go travel? Newport in the winter or Las Vegas, you know, in the summer? That sounds a lot more exotic. I mean, granted, it is a desert. But, you know, back then in the late 1940s, early 1950s, it's highly appealing. So thousands of people from Newport go out. I mean, so much so that this is when Dixie Chili begins canning their chili, and that becomes a major portion of their business. They would send it out to the ton, out to Las Vegas. So when you look at kind of all these things, what really happens to Newport is because that becomes the more exotic location, Newport starts losing a little business. I mean, even a 10% decline when you're at your peak in a gambling industry, you know, it hurts. So when you start seeing a 30% decline in people start getting desperate. You start seeing more bust out joints. You start seeing even the legitimate joints doing bad things. And so by the time you get to like the late 1959, 1960s, the citizens surrounding Newport have kind of had enough of the reputation. It had actually grown from just this paradise and wonderful place that was safe, et cetera, to, you know, a place you really want to have your family.
Terry, how widespread did the corruption get in Newport as a result of all this?
As far as politics?
Yeah, as far as politics, as far as the police department?
Oh, everybody was – everybody, even into the early 70s. There was almost everybody got a piece of the action. It was, and that's how you ran things. There were never any problems as a result, you know. But I can remember sitting in a certain bar that was owned by a friend of mine and watching the detectives come in and have a couple of drinks and leave with money in their hand. You know, that was it's the way it was, and pretty much politics the same way. The city commission at that time, for a number of years, simply looked the other way. Nobody complained. Nobody really had any problems. So you just, you know, just let it go. And they were, again, they were all getting their piece of the action. And and all the big-time club owners, gamblers, all lived in Fort Thomas anyway. They didn't even live in Newport. They all lived in Fort Thomas. Right. That's how the mob eventually, the Cleveland guys, got Beverly. He didn't want to – Pete said, you know, I'm not going to sell. So they had a little fire. And when the fire wasn't enough, they put a little dynamite in his basement of his house in Fort Thomas because I was in the house. I saw where it, you know. And after the dynamite, he said, yep, I'll sell. And then he built the Playtorium, what is now called the Syndicate, the building on Fifth Street. He built the Playtorium. He sold Beverly to the boys.
Yeah, you also have to remember too, right? So there was corruption, but there's also everybody. This is how they made their living. Okay, so you're a high school graduate or even a high school dropout, and you run the card tables, and you're making an upper middle class salary. You know, you're a waiter or a waitress. You're making an upper middle class salary. So you know, not only. You know, are they
so to that extent, it was good for the economy.
It was extremely good for the economy. I mean, and that's what allowed it to stay open so long. I mean, there probably isn't a church in Newport, Kentucky, and probably Fort Thomas and even parts of Covington, you know, where the pews weren't paid with money from this industry. You know, you look at the little league teams. I mean, some of these guys that we met out in Las Vegas, they talk about how their softball team was sponsored, you know, or their little league team was sponsored, or you know, everybody's got stories about how, you know, they needed something one special year for their theater at their school, and these guys came through and paid for it. So it was the industry. This is how we earn our living, right? And so with that, even if you're not making money, you want to keep your citizens happy. No one's complaining about anything. You know, the few instances where there was violence, you know, and when I say few, there was enough, right?
So there's this kind of strange orderliness about the whole thing, as long as you don't make somebody mad.
Right. Well, so when you have like Terry said, when you have the dynamite and the different things and the intimidation of Pete Schmidt, that wasn't the only place it happened, you know. So there was kind of like this formula. You know, first we make a lucrative offer to the national groups, would make a lucrative offer to take over or partner with you. And when you wouldn't sell, then they would start with harassment, encourage you to sell again, and then eventually it would get violent. So you got, you know, three shootings we know about for sure that happened with Red Masterson, you know, on a few blocks. I mean, Red Masterson, talk about somebody that lived, you know, right there in Fort Thomas. His house is right across the street from the
– He was a friend of my father-in-law.
You knew everybody, didn't you?
Well, if I didn't, I knew people who did know everybody, it seemed like. A lot of the leftovers, I knew – Sam Eisner, not well. Unfortunately, he wasn't around too long by the time I was really into the Newport scene a lot more. Same way with Screw Andrews. I knew Screw, but right only a couple of years before he died. Sammy Wright, a lot of those guys that didn't go to Vegas. And I was around long enough with some of those people that when you'd sit down and start talking, they loved to talk, and I was a sports writer. Well, they thought that was great, you know. So we'd sit and talk and talk, and the stories were just, you know, and they didn't have any reason to make up stories. They had stuff going on. I mean, Screw Andrews was a bad guy. he was a bad guy. He'd put a pistol on you so fast. I mean, it meant nothing to him to shoot somebody. That's how he was. He was of that order that something got out of hand, you settled it with a gun.
Hang on to that thought, Jerry. We'll come back to this. We need to take a quick break here, and we will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Here to discuss Newport's history are American Legacy Tours co-founder Jerry Gels and retired Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Terry Flynn. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Just out of curiosity, Jerry, why Newport? Why not Louisville? Why not Lexington? Why not some other city in Kentucky?
So number one, well, there's really a ton of reasons, but Newport's right across from Cincinnati, right? Cincinnati has a large population at the time, about 400,000 people. They have lots of conventions that come to town, and Northern Kentucky has always had kind of this reputation of being the entertainment area. You see the Hofbräu House, the Levee, the Aquarium, and so forth, and that's where a lot of your streetcars ended. And you had two amusement parks over there. You had a series of clubs. You actually in Northern Kentucky history, there was two horse parks. At one point, for a short while, there was a dog track. You know, so there was just always this kind of stuff happening over there. And like I said earlier, you know, there was always this kind of take care of your own mentality with that group. Mm-hmm. And between the anti-immigrant and the federal government taking away the way most of these people made their living, which during Prohibition was the Wiedemann Brewery, it was responsible for about 25% of the overall economy of that town. So when they shut that down, which, you know, everybody in that city was readily confused, and then the government also tries to suppress a strike, you know, with Newport Steel, there's just a lot of resentment in the city with the federal and the state government. And so with that, they really do everything they can to keep themselves out. Now, you also have George Remus who comes to town. Now, he's one of the biggest bootleggers, and I don't want to go too much into his story. But, you know, when you have one of the largest – I mean, George Remus was bigger than Capone, you know, with the amount of money that he was making and bringing in. So when these guys taste that money and they understand the sophistication that you need to be in this world – can't just be a thug. You can't just be someone beating people up. You have to have some business sense to it. They take that skill that they have, and they set up shop in Newport.
How much of the sports betting that you see going on in Vegas nowadays, how much is that modeled after what went on in Newport?
Well, from what I've always heard is that was the start. It was, of course, illegal, like Jerry was saying. All of that, regardless of what the gambling was, it was illegal. But as long as they could do it, it was just another way to make money. Everybody loved to bet on baseball, football, basketball, whatever, you know. And that was probably what, Jerry, that was started in, I guess, probably the 50s.
Yeah. It's the 1930s, 1940s, but really the 40s, okay? So the legacy of gambling in Greater Cincinnati and in Newport is incredible, right? So you have Pete Rose. You know, would Pete Rose have been Pete Rose, you know, if he was raised in any other area, right? So gambling is just, especially sports gambling, has always been readily accepted in this area. But again, it's Newport that shows that this can be a business model. You know, how many people, if I were to tell you today, we're going to set up a casino and you're going to run the casino and you're going to make your money on how often you as a dealer is going to win at blackjack. I mean, it's only like 51% odds that the house is going to win. But because it's stacked in your favor, and then it's this same group that learns how to make sports betting lucrative, you know? And look what they tried doing with it too. I mean, UK, you know, there's a whole sports history there where those guys were throwing games, you know, and it was all tied to the illegal gambling in Newport and in other areas. But the folks that would settle and make millions in Newport, they were tied to that scandal. You know, you have the Black Sox scandal, and everybody blames the Black Sox, but did you know on the Cincinnati Reds side, we started throwing games. You know, we started throwing because they were
talking about that scandal back in 1919.
You know, so just the legacy of sports gambling, you know, in this area is incredible. And number two, it's really this area that shows that this is going to be lucrative. And it's the sports gambling that's ultimately responsible for the complete closure of Newport. You see, You know, once a couple of bad things happen, which we can maybe talk about here in a little bit, but there's rules, federal communications laws, that say that you can't use your telephones because they're going across state lines for legal purposes. So if you're taking a sports bet, they don't have to have a warrant in Kentucky or Newport, you know, to see you. They can have that warrant in Ohio. They tap it. They realize you're betting. They come in and they shut everything down. Hmm.
So what's the story of George Ratterman and this Committee of 500? Was that one of the earliest reform movements?
Well, it was the reform movement.
It was the whole reform movement.
I knew a lot of those folks because obviously they were when Ratterman
– And he was the sheriff, right?
Or he was running for sheriff and, of course, was ultimately elected. I was working when he went to trial – at the federal building in Covington. I was a copy boy at the Post. I was right out of high school. And I remember going over there, and everybody was there. It was amazing. And the whole thing, it was a circus. The way it was put together was ridiculous. He knew all those guys, of course. I mean, everybody that was involved in it, Screw and the rest of them. George had known him for years. There was nothing new about that. And he was in Newport a lot. He spent a fair amount of time in some of the different clubs and that. And for some reason, they thought that they could pull a fast one and keep him from getting the sheriff's job by this now famous story of the Mickey and the stripper and the whole thing. And it's just, you know, the whole thing.
So somebody drugs him?
Oh, sure. Probably chloral hydrate. That was what they usually used for Mickeys back then. And then they had a photographer come in and take pictures of him with Juanita Hodges, April Flowers, the stripper. And what they didn't anticipate, I guess, was...
So they were going to blackmail him. George and, the whole idea
sure,
of this.
George okay. and family immediately went to the FBI. Well, he still had it in his system. They did a blood test, and he still had it in his system. Well, then the whole thing blew up.
I spoke
and eventually they were indicted.
With George's family, like he said, because he had, you know, George is a sports player. He's a quarterback, you know.
He was an All-American.
He had this All-American boy image.
And he played for Cleveland. He was on cover of Sports Illustrated. And again, here's a sports person leading, you know, the reform. So, but, you know, I spoke with his kids, and they said the longest day in his life was when he woke up because the wife was nervous that he was out there cheating on her, like, you know, because she was mad she wouldn't talk to him for
Oh, wow.
So I mean, so it wasn't. So he said, I swear it wasn't. You know, they went and drug tested, but you know, it's incredible, you know, the brazenness, but also like you said, how here you got a guy that's going to clean up the city that was known for you know just hanging out casually because that's what people did. You went to these places because they were establishments.
And the bulk of the people in the Committee 500 were from Fort Thomas anyway. You had a lot of doctors, lawyers, and so forth that formed the Committee of 500. In fact, to this day, I know the sons of a number of people who were members of the Committee of 500. And they got the job done. It worked.
513-419-7100, and Bob joins us now. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yes, as far as the George Ratterman thing, who was Tito Carinci or Carincini? I know he was also a football player.
Carinci.
He's the one who set Ratterman up.
Right. Yeah, he's from Youngstown, Ohio, and he would go to Xavier when Xavier had a football team and he played there. And there, he was actually pretty good, but never quite good enough, I think, to make the NFL. I think he had a couple trials with the Dolphins. But he comes over. He's actually a cousin of Dean Martin's. And he was the one, he was paid by the Cleveland Syndicate, that it was his decision to basically, from what everybody says, drug Ratterman. And he kind of set up. He was the one that called for the meeting that night with Ratterman. The meeting was actually supposed to be about sporting goods sales because that's what Ratterman's main business was. That's what he was doing for a living. And since they were former sports colleagues and had crossed paths a couple of times, he went down there to meet with them. So – there's a lot of confusion. You know, people say that that Carinci was eventually, prosecuted or tried for perjury. He wasn't, or he was never really found guilty of that. There's all kinds of different people that speak of his personality, but from what I understand, he was fairly well liked guy. It wasn't a hothead or anything like that. But you know, people have a lot of big heart for Tito.
Where's Robert Kennedy come into this?
Well, 62 basically. and he brought in the FBI after the Ratterman trial, when those guys were convicted, Tito and I guess Screw was convicted too, I think.
Screw would be later. Screw would be with when Robert Kennedy came in. So most of the people that are prosecuted after that trial were all people that they just came in through and just started shutting down gambling instances. The only two people that were really – and nothing actually happened because we've had to go and look at some of these court dates because of some of the family members being upset about different things that had been said previously before our tour started. But Tito and I believe April never served any kind of time for it.
No. Yeah. Once they started shutting them down, the Lassoff brothers, Sleep Out Louie, they all went to Vegas at that point. There was no reason to stay in Newport because there was no money anymore. And they all left and went to Vegas.
Yeah, and the fact that, like you said, there's no money, you don't have as many people because this is a very bad advertisement. But if you have a layoff bank here and you're betting millions of dollars and it could be gone tomorrow, you know, by a federal government coming in, you need to get that out.
So a layoff bank is?
So let's say, you know, it's Frazier and Ali, right? And you're taking a lot of bets and suddenly you have so many.
You just can't handle
it. You can't handle it. You call the layoff bank. So it's, you know, like I said.
And that was in Newport.
The sophistication is incredible, you know.
So what happens? We have the reform effort. You have Robert Kennedy, the FBI, the federal government cracking down on all this. What happens to the mobsters? How many of them head west? How many of them stay home?
Well, there was nobody left. Certainly by the time I really got to know anybody, like I said, I knew Screw a little bit at the end. Sammy Wright owned a little bar at that point. Other than that, pretty much everybody was gone. There was no reason. Like I said, there was no reason
to stick
around
anymore.
Yeah.
Okay.
And your biggest names really didn't. You know, the people that ran and operated the casinos, like Sam Tucker, who was part of the Cleveland Syndicate. You know, he probably lived in the area the longest, and that was really only until like the early 50s. You know, most of the members, once they saw the kind of money they can make in a legal place, but I guess I compare Newport to kind of like being, you know. These kind of like branding hubs are like where you start a business, right? You know, like an accelerator where you're going to try and experiment and see if this really works, right? And that's what Newport did. Newport demonstrated to the rest of the world that when you have open and legal gambling, although it was illegal, and you create a place to attract the best, you are going to make serious money.
How much interest is there in this aspect of Newport's history?
Well, I would tell you, since starting our tours, we started in 2009 as a fundraiser, which is an interesting story, right? Like I thought on that opening weekend, because I was raising money for a student trip that we get 200. City of Newport didn't want me to do it. After like four or five emails asking them if they were going to do anything to stop me, they said, no, we can't stop you, but we don't want you to do it. So I did it anyway. And I had brought in, instead of 200 people, there was 1,200 people over two weekends that came on the tour. At that point, then the city of Newport said, man, we really like what you did because all these people filled our restaurants, right, at a time when they're not normally busy. So could you keep – you know, your teacher, could you keep doing it? And I did. But we get – I think we've had probably just on our tours – on all our tours, it's around 450,000 people, and our Newport tours were probably approaching 100,000 that have been on it so far.
Jerry and Terry, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. American Legacy Tours co-founder Jerry Gels and retired Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Terry Flynn. And coming up, three UC students start a project to create sidekicks for children who are homeless. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.